Well, hey everybody, welcome to the next episode of New Hope Underground. This is Pastor Tyler Sturkey here with a couple friends in our community that we wanted to maybe begin to hear their story. It's the Sanchez family. So glad you guys are joining us today. Specifically, we're going to be hearing Caitlin's story. For those who attend New Hope, who are listening, you know that she was one of two people that had shared her testimony of how Jesus gave her hope on Easter Sunday. And man, had a lot of reactions. A lot of people approach her and talk to her. And even people made comments to us on staff just about how powerful it was. Sorry, I'm talking a lot. Hi, Caitlin. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm good.
And her husband, Richard, is in the room too. Give a big shout out. Maybe we can catch it on mic. Hey, Richard, how are you?
Good. How are you guys doing?
Yeah, he's given moral support in it. And so anyway, Caitlin, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Glad to be here. Yeah, excited for this opportunity.
Awesome. Glad you could be here. Would you like to maybe just give a snapshot of your life and your family right now, just so people know maybe just who you are in general?
Yeah. So I'm Caitlin. I'm married to Richard. I'm 29 years old, about to be 30, the big 30 in a couple months. We have three kids together. Jericho is 7, Jaslyn is 4, and Josiah is 2. Mm-hmm. So we have our hands full. We're pretty busy. I just started a new job about a month and a half ago as a behavioral health counselor for Effingham County Probation.
Oh, wow.
So that's been interesting and fun, and getting to put my degree and skills to use. So, yeah.
That's awesome. Well, very cool. Well, hey, glad you are joining us today. And so, like I had said, she got to share a brief form. I mean, it was probably 5 to 7 minutes in the service before, because we had two different people sharing. Noah Prosser was another one, which he's actually been interviewed in the past on New Hope Underground as well. So you can actually, if you want to go back into the archives of episodes, you can listen to the long form version of his.
Yeah, and I listened to his. It was really powerful.
Yeah,
I appreciated that.
Very, very cool. But anyway, we had known, even when we were kind of brainstorming and thinking of, you know, who could share their story, you know, on Easter Sunday, your name came up almost immediately. And of course, we already knew Noah had done like the long form interview too. His was kind of backwards. He shared the long form and then did the short one on a Sunday morning. You shared your in the short version first. And all the pastors were like, we're going to interview her on New Hope Underground, right? And I'm like, oh yeah, absolutely. Like, I already kind of had that in the back of my mind that I would invite you to be a part of it and just kind of let you tell long form to share whatever details is as detailed or not detailed as you wanted.
Yeah. 'Cause
you've got a story. I mean, you've seen some stuff and walked a road, and God has been present in it and in the midst of all of it. Like, I think that was the thing I was in awe of the most when you shared, 'cause I honestly didn't know anything about your story until, 'cause we kind of had you guys write it out just so it helps you know, like, okay, I'm saying everything I want to say, but also from a time perspective too, because I know, believe me, as a pastor and someone who's verbose, how I can mean to be 5 minutes and I go 30 minutes.
Sure.
And so it, even from a time perspective, but then when you shared what you did and like you shared it with me, I'm reading this, I'm like, oh my gosh, I had no idea. I just had no idea what a lot of people had recommended, but I didn't know any of the details.
Yeah, most people don't.
and so when I shared it, my wife even said something too of like, because I think she's got to know you in other contexts, mm-hmm. but she's like, yeah, you just don't know what people's stories are. So she's like, anyway, so when I told her we're doing a long form interview of it, she's like, I'm so interested to hear it. Like, it's going to be.
Yeah, most people, I think I look like a quiet, reserved, you know, good girl, and people look at me and
little
like,
do they know.
Yeah. You know, it's the quiet ones you got to watch out for, right?
That's right. That's right. I wonder that with kids too. It's the quiet kids you got to watch out for. No. But anyway, so yeah, I figured, I mean, we'll just go all the way back to the beginning and maybe kind of talk about the seasons of your life and where, I mean, we always talk about that, just that golden thread of faith and in the beginnings of that and how it's woven and just what it looks like in different seasons of our lives. So, I mean, let's go all the way back to the beginning of your, your life growing up. And so maybe tell us just a little bit about your family and just, I mean, I know you can't remember when you're a baby, but you know, the earliest memories and what life was like in your family.
Yeah. So I was born in Carbondale in 94. So I'm a hippie at heart. And we moved back here when I was like 3 and a half. So I've grown up in Effingham for as long as I can remember. My parents are both Christians. I grew up going to First Baptist Church here in Effingham. My parents went there, grandparents went there. So pretty much born and raised Southern Baptist.
Sure. Do you have siblings?
Yes, I'm okay. The oldest of five. That's a good thing mention, I guess.
I honestly didn't know that. I didn't know if you had siblings or not.
That makes me part of who I am, being the oldest of five kids.
Oh, you're the oldest. Okay.
Yeah, all right. So it's me and then one brother and then three sisters. So poor brother, he's got four sisters.
Lots of female energy. Being a father of two daughters, being the only male presence in the house, I can appreciate that you feel a bit outnumbered.
Yeah, so... being the oldest, I was kind of like the second mom, I guess, you know.
What's the age gap between the siblings?
We're all about 2 years apart, pretty close. Lots of responsibility. I felt like growing up, I don't know if my parents would think I was as responsible as I feel like I was, but
you felt that.
And, you know, I was kind of like the little supervisor, like, parents told the little kids to go clean their rooms, they'd be like, Caitlin, go make sure they clean their room.
keep all the younglings in line.
Yeah, so I guess that's perks of having lots of kids.
Yeah, so what was family life growing up? Maybe, and I mean, keeping in mind that like thread of faith, like what was that like growing up in a church-going family, and how do you feel like that shaped things in you even then?
So, like I said, grew up going to FBC. We went... Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, any extra activities they had, dinners, anything like that. And my dad was a deacon, well, still is a deacon. So,
That's cool.
We were always, you know, one of the first people to get there and the last people to leave. So my parents would be like breaking down tables and chairs and we're just running around, you know, deacon's kids. Like they say, the deacon's kids and the pastor's kids.
Yeah, you got to watch out for them.
Church was always part of our family and faith was part of our family. When I was 7 years old, I was at school on the playground and I was a shy, kind of lonely kid. I didn't have a lot of friends. It was just painful for me to talk to people. You know, I didn't like to approach people and be social. I still don't really like that.
Sure. You're just more introverted by nature.
Yeah, I am.
And that's the way my wife is of like, you're okay having one or two really good friends.
Yeah.
You don't feel like you have to have 30.
Oh, no, that's exhausting.
Yeah, you're like, oh, man, I'm tired just thinking about that.
Yeah. So I was just by myself on the playground one day in second grade, and I just felt this kind of voice in my head, something about Jesus, and I just was like, I think I need Jesus, you know, and just in that moment, I just realized, you know, on the playground by myself, I need Jesus. So I went home and talked to my parents about that. And my dad prayed with me that night to become a Christian.
Wow.
And I was baptized shortly after that. And we celebrated that.
7 years old. That's
awesome. Yeah, 7 years old.
Wow.
And I was in Bible drills at church where we memorized Bible verses and passages. So I feel like that helped me to learn the scripture and learn important verses in the Bible. So I was able to internalize that from a young age, which I think gave me, kind of an advantage. You know, even though I strayed from the path later.
It's the proverb about raise a child up in the way they should go. And when they're older, they won't depart from it. That there's a foundation there that you would have, we're getting ahead of ourselves, but would eventually return to. So that, I mean, that's even interesting that you recognize that there was a foundation that was laid, that there's almost an anchor that you could return to later.
Yeah. And the pastor at our church, Roger Marshall,
growing
up, he's a very godly man. And
I actually just saw him, that was maybe not quite a month ago. There are these like regional hubs that like the IBSA, like the state denomination, mm-hmm. where pastors from a region were kind of divided into regions will gather together and they have like breakouts and stuff like that.
Cool.
And I was there because it was in the one I went to was in Benton, which is actually where they're living now.
Yes.
And so he wasn't even there for the regional thing. He was in just in the, cause he attends at that church.
Right.
And we almost have this moment where he looks at him. I'm like, Roger, he's like, Tyler. It's like, we go up and shake hands and like catch up. Cause it'd been a while since we'd seen each other.
Yeah. He's a great pastor and definitely missed here in town.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So growing up, in that church and being the thoughtful and introspective kind of person that I am, I feel like I actually paid attention in church more than maybe other little kids did.
Yeah.
And so even if I didn't understand everything at the time and didn't live it out, I at least was getting that and hearing that. And I could later look back and reflect on that. So
yeah,
I definitely had that advantage as a kid of being raised in a Christian home and a godly church that really preaches the Bible for what it is, you know.
So then as you began to get a little bit older, because I think a shift from you, even from what you shared on like on Easter, the shift began for you in your teenage years. So that'd be junior high. Stuff began to, like, what shifted and when did it shift? Maybe that's all asked. Just set it up so you can talk about it.
I think in junior high, it started, and not with behavior issues so much, but just an internal mental and emotional kind of shift started to happen. And I still don't know exactly why. I don't know if it's genetic predisposition or if it was external factors, but just started to get kind of resentful and angry and just like I had a chip on my shoulder, you know. Started to talk back to my parents some, and that was, I mean, not really permitted, you know, like you don't talk back to your parents kind of thing. And,
is just being a teen. I mean, it's all the hormones that come with being, you know, a teenager like that.
Maybe going into puberty.
Yeah. But it just looks different in every person. And so this was the unique way it was kind of showing up in you.
Yeah, so it started to get a little darker. I do think I was born with depression. I think that's something I've always had. I wasn't diagnosed until high school, but I know around puberty, depression can kind of start to show itself more. And it definitely was starting to get darker in my mind. So that could have been depression, too. It's just hard to say, really, and it could be a number of things, but yeah, I think around 7th, 8th grade was when that shift started to happen internally.
And how did that, like, in terms of, again, the golden thread, the like faith life, was anything different or began to shift just as you began to experience that in your life? Like, what did faith begin to look like during that season?
So I was still going to FBC. I was in youth group there, started in that in 7th grade. And we had a big youth group, and we had two different youth pastors in the time that I was in youth group. And I would say our second youth pastor that we had, Josh Bledsoe,
also know Josh and also love him.
Yes. He is a great godly man also, who talked to me a lot and gave me a lot of good advice, talked me through a lot of things. And we did fun trips like youth encounter and, extreme winter, I think is what it was called. Yeah. Conferences over in Branson. And,
oh, cool.
Got to hear like Skillet like 5 times. So oh, nice. That was fun. They're my favorite.
Yeah.
I had lots of church involvement still and had positive people in my life. I don't think that I was really living out a relationship with God. You know, I didn't pray about things. I didn't talk to God about my feelings, you know, my resentment and stuff like I probably should have. So I had prayed to become a Christian, but I just don't feel like I had that relationship yet.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I was at that point.
Sure. So as you began to get into high school, how did things shift then? Because I think from what I remember, in high school, there were some things that began to happen.
Yeah, high school, and my parents will tell you this too. That's when things started to really go downhill. I started to hang out with kind of the wrong friends. I had a friend, freshman year. She was new to the school, and well, I was new to the school too because I was a freshman, but she was new to Effingham, and we started to hang out, and she was into lots of bad things, and I just kind of got introduced to that, and someone offered me cigarettes for the first time. They said, hey, if you're stressed out and have headaches all the time, you should try smoking because it helps with that. You won't feel so stressed. It'll make your headaches go away. I was like, okay, I'll try that. So started smoking cigarettes at 14. Then I had my first drink when I was 14 of vodka. And I just wanted to kind of make the pain I was feeling better. So I started cutting, and I would just cut to, I don't know if it was to cover the pain or to be able to feel something, you know?
Yeah, that's what,
or both.
Yeah, when I've heard people, and I've counseled people, talked with people who have experienced that, and yeah, I feel like those are the common things that I've heard and kind of explained is, it's either I feel numb, and so I do that so I feel something, or what I'm feeling is bad, and so it's like I almost want to like cover it.
Yeah.
Like get me to focus on something outside of myself, even though it's still my body. I'd rather feel, I mean, it's the emotion. I think the way I've heard it described was the emotional pain is so bad, I'd rather feel physical pain than the emotional pain that I'm feeling. Yeah, and it's almost like if I could turn up one speaker so loud, I can't hear the other sound that I'm hearing that I don't want to hear. Yeah. And that's tough. Like that's a thing.
I think that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, this friend that I had started hanging out with, she was cutting too. So I kind of like learned, I mean, I knew about it, but I kind of like learned more about it from her. And so I guess we had this like kind of bond, this kind of sick, twisted bond. Sure. Where we were both like cutting and smoking and stuff like that.
I mean, there's that sense of, we always see camaraderie in anything, really. I mean, like there's the cliche saying that misery loves company.
Oh, yeah.
But there's even a sense of like, if I'm going through something difficult, even knowing someone else is going through it too, it doesn't necessarily make it better, but at least there's a sense of companionship or camaraderie even in the pain.
Yeah. Yeah. So then after freshman year, I started doing pretty bad in classes. I've always been intelligent and able to make straight A's, and but I just kind of started to give up and let it slide. I started failing classes or, you know, getting C's and below, and that just wasn't like me.
Was the mindset like, who cares? So I'm just going to, like, not even try?
Kind of, yeah, like that depression, like, nothing really matters, or like, I'm not worth it, like, why should I even try kind of thing.
Now, did your parents... I mean, because those were a lot of new things that were introduced, even your freshman year. I mean, clearly your parents are seeing at bare minimum the consequences of those things. Like they're seeing something different begin to change. Did they know about any of what was happening?
Yeah, they're very involved parents. So they're smart, and they're landlords here in town, and they've learned how to stalk people.
We're going to get that rent money one way or another. You can't hide for very long.
Especially when you're, you know, vetting a potential tenant and you want to know if they're going to be a good tenant or not. You know,
you need ways of finding out about people.
Yeah. So they knew how to find things out. And when it's your own kid, you know, you're much more motivated to find those things out. So, yeah, they're pretty good detectives, and they're smart, and they notice things. And we started to have arguments a lot. Which, with me being the first kid, I do feel like they were more strict with me. Like, we had rules about, you know, when you do your homework, you need to sit at your desk and have your door shut and, you know, don't have music playing and have a light turned on. And, you know, it was like very structured. And if I didn't, then it was like an argument. I'm like, well, I don't want my door shut, or I focus better with music. Well, you can't have music. And so we started to argue over little things like that. And then they did find out when I had my first drink of alcohol, and they, I don't remember if they found out about the smoking right away or not. But they did find out about the cutting too. And that's when they had me start counseling. And I started with a Christian counselor here in town who has, she's been a big influence on my life. Someone that I've seen for a long time.
And so you started seeing a counselor even then in high school?
Yes, yeah, as a freshman in high school. I think I saw her like 3 of my 4 years in high school. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of an ongoing thing. And not that I really listened to what she told me at the time at all, but it was just nice to have a person that listened to me and was supportive and that I could say anything to, you know, and just know that they wouldn't go tell my parents or somebody else. And I wouldn't get in trouble.
Yeah. I mean, that shows even a desire for community there of like, we desire to have people in our lives that we can be fully honest with and know we'll still be accepted. And so, I mean, gosh, even as a teenager for that to be desired and like, I mean, even though it didn't necessarily, you're like, oh, I'm not going to do it, but still like having a space that I can actually be honest and know that there's not like immediate consequences. Like that's, I think that's a human desire. That's normal.
Yeah. And then with like the whole threat of faith thing, freshman year, I feel like was when I started to kind of fall away from like talking to God and thinking about God. It just kind of went to like the back of my mind, and I didn't really think about it much, but there was one time, I think it was freshman year, when I could tell things were getting pretty dark. And I remember in my bedroom one day just crying and asking God, like, if you're real, would you just help me or show me something? Let me know, you know, because I could feel myself even then, you know, going downhill and just feeling how dark things were in my mind. And I was like, you know, if God is real and if all this stuff I learned in church is true, like, why is this happening or why am I like this, you know?
Yeah, sure.
So that's one specific moment that I remember just kind of crying out to God and being like, you know, if you're real, just show yourself to me. And then I think because of the way I was living life, I wasn't really seeking God, even though I sought him in that prayer, you know, I wasn't really seeking him with my life, you know? And so of course I didn't get an answer because I wasn't living in a way that I would listen to God and hear his answer, you know?
That's interesting. You make that, which I mean, hindsight is 20/20. So you're probably recognizing that, but that's interesting that you would say that because I mean, maybe even in the moment you felt that of like, God doesn't care because he didn't answer me. Mm-hmm. But for you to say like, he probably did answer, but I was not in a place to listen. Like there's insight to that.
Yeah, I mean, I had my Christian parents I could have listened to. I had my Christian counselor I could have listened to. I had my youth pastor and pastor, you know, there were plenty of opportunities to listen to God and follow his calling. I just wasn't living that way.
Yeah, that's interesting. So yeah, continuing on in high school, like what began to happen?
So between freshman and sophomore year over the summer, my dad, who I think was 49, maybe 47, in his later 40s at the time, had to have an emergency open heart surgery. Oh, wow. They told him he was probably within a week of having a heart attack and dying. And so he had triple heart bypass surgery. And that was a big deal. That was a really scary thing for me when they wheeled him away and we said goodbye. And I didn't know if he would make it through surgery or not. And I knew the doctors were good, but, you know, you just never know what's going to happen. And he was so young and I was so young. And that was a really hard thing emotionally. And he did just fine. He did better than expected, which was great. But after that, there was a lot of pressure I felt like on me as the oldest to kind of help take care of things.
Yeah.
Because my mom had to do all the business stuff for the real estate business and take care of five kids and take care of her husband. Yeah. After having such a big surgery. So it was a lot for her. Mm. But I felt like it was a lot for me too, as the oldest kid. And I just got so pressured. Plus I had already been in a dark place. And so I started to steal my dad's pain medicine. He was getting, I think, hydrocodone or something like that.
Yeah.
And I started to just take one every once in a while. And my mom was counting the pills, so I didn't want them to go missing too fast. I guess I was a little sociopath, but
yeah. I mean, we learn how to hide stuff, and that's, I feel like, especially as a teenager, you quickly learn how try to get away with things and hide things. And so they they noticed that pills started to go missing.
I think they did notice, but didn't really know what was happening. I don't think that they thought that I would be taking those pills. But I was taking them, and I really liked them. They made me feel better. They made me feel numb.
Yeah.
And my new thing was I'll do anything to be out of my right mind, even if it's for like a minute, you know?
Wow. Okay.
And that's just what I wanted. I just wanted to be out of my right mind all the time.
Sure.
And so I was taking pain pills, and then school started, and man, high school is a pill mill. Mm. And I still had this friend, and I had other friends then. You know, I built up my network of bad people. Yeah. And started to get more pills and different things. I was taking hydrocodone and Xanax to sleep, and then I was taking Adderall to be up. Mm. So I was on this roller coaster then of up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. And it was exhausting just to have those mood swings that go along with that, you know, when you're up for several days at a time and then you're down and crashing and sleeping for several days. And with Xanax, if you take too much, if you're abusing it, you just don't know what's going on. Mm. I just have so many blackout moments. I don't even remember what happened, you know? And so that was kind of the rest of high school, was on pills. And
and family didn't know, or at least
they didn't know really. And I kind of did pills on purpose because I was like, what can I do that my parents won't find out about? And I knew if I smoked weed, you know, they could smell it or find the paraphernalia. Or if I, you know, did other things, you know, there's like bloodshot eyes and your breath. And, you know, so I really thought through this, and I was like, pills, I can do pills. And it was like an aha moment. I was so excited. I was like, I can do pills, and, you know, my eyes won't be bloodshot, and they won't smell it, and there's no paraphernalia, you know, it doesn't leave a trail. And so that's really that like kind of criminal thinking behavior.
Sure.
Where I really thought through that and was intentional and sought that out for a specific reason. And so they didn't know for a long time. There was one day, like, I told my mom this already, but there was one day I was sick. I was sick for several days. I actually had to stay home from school because I was throwing up. I was just so sick. I couldn't go to school. Couldn't really get out of bed. And my mom thought I had the flu, and she was so kind to take such good care of me. But she didn't know that I had actually had too many pills, and I was so sick. I couldn't get out of bed. Mm. And I felt so bad because I'm like, my mom is so nice. She's just taking care of me, and she doesn't even know, like, this is what I did. So I did feel really bad about it. I knew that what I was doing wasn't right. And that just made me feel like such garbage, you know?
Sure.
And my self-esteem was definitely just through the floor, you know? And but I couldn't stop. And there were several times in high school that I wanted to stop. And I would try to stop, but I just couldn't. It was so hard. Pills are so addictive. And in junior year, I remember I thought, what if I get back to God? What if I read the Bible more and start praying more? And so beginning of junior year, I started taking my Bible to school with me, and I would read my Bible at school. And I was really trying to just kind of white knuckle my way through it. And I was like, I'm strong. I can do this. And I thought if I just read the Bible, you know, that would be like the magic cure. And it didn't work after like
Which
a
is
month.
It's interesting even seeing that, I mean, yeah, white knuckling our way through the spiritual life doesn't work. Mm-mm. But it's interesting to see the desire for God was still there.
Yeah.
Even though you didn't know, you're kind of grasping in the dark for him. I mean, we've been doing this series about desires.
Yeah.
Even though they can be, they're disordered by, our desires are disordered by sin. The desire's still there, though, that it's built in us to,
yeah,
even if it's in a flailing blind way, to reach out to God, to reach out, you know, to have some sort of connection. So it's even, yeah. I just wanted to like stop and note that it's like, it's interesting, even in the midst of all that darkness, there's still something in you that was like reaching out, that foundation, yeah, that you mentioned from before.
And that's why I'm so thankful that I was raised in church and in a Christian home. Cause I mean, I know so many people don't have that. And when they, you know, they're in that dark place and they're reaching for something, but they don't know what, because they don't know that it's God. And I was fortunate enough to know that. But so many people just don't know that that's the answer. And,
yeah,
you know, there's so many things in this world that promise happiness and answers and cures and fixes, but it only comes from God.
Sure.
And, you know, even though I wasn't living it at the time, I knew that on a deep level.
So, yeah, so keep going. So
yeah,
junior year, there was some, a renewed reaching out for God, but didn't quite.
Yeah, it didn't work. I think that lasted a month or two. And then I was right back to the pills and smoking. And I had, back then, you know, the smoking age was 18. So I had a friend who was 18 in high school, and he was kind of the one that got cigarettes for everyone. And so I was smoking and not drinking too much, because it was kind of hard to get alcohol. I didn't know anyone really over 21 that would get me alcohol. So mostly pills and smoking and cutting. And then senior year, I actually liked my classes. I liked all my teachers. I was interested in what I was studying, but I was still doing pills. And I eventually got caught. Someone told on me, someone that I was actually, you know, buying and selling with. And, they got in trouble and they told on me. And so I got caught with a bag of Flexeril, which is a muscle relaxer, not a super strong one, but, it's a prescription med. So you're not supposed to have it in high school,
yeah,
without a prescription, which is understandable. And so I got called down to the office, and I ended up getting suspended that day. And then I had an expulsion hearing, and, because of the school's zero tolerance policy, I was expelled. And that was October of my senior year of high school. And my parents were just crushed. They were so disappointed. And I think it was embarrassing and hard for them, you know, to be a Christian family and to be a deacon at church, and to have this image, and then have a daughter that gets expelled from high school for having pills, you know. But honestly, I was not that sad. I hated going to school from the time I was in kindergarten. I actually woke up on my third day of kindergarten when my mom woke me up for school, and I said, "Mommy, how many more days do I have to do this?" Because I am not a morning person, so 6 a.m. is not my time to shine. And my mom was like, let's see, you're in kindergarten, so like 13 more years.
Oh, My kids have asked that too, so I need to be mindful of that then.
Yeah. So I hated school. I begged my mom to be homeschooled so many times, and I think she kind of wanted to, like, she knew I would benefit from that, but she was like, you know, I just can't, you know, if I homeschool you, then I have to homeschool your other siblings too, because, you know, they're not going to think that's fair. And she had the business to run too, and I understand why she couldn't do that.
Sure.
But yeah, I was not sad to get expelled. I actually had a relief, like, oh my gosh, I don't have to go back there again.
And it's hard that it was, I mean, one, it's your senior year, but yeah, two, just when you're starting to actually have classes that you like.
Yeah, the first time I enjoyed my classes, and I did actually miss my teachers and classes some, but I was not upset about leaving the school in general and just having to get up early in the morning and go be social around, you know, like 800 other people every day.
Yeah. Okay, so you're expelled. Then what happens after that?
So I got into Pathways, which is an alternative high school, and ended up graduating from there in March of my senior year. So I actually graduated a couple months ahead of the rest of my class. And I did get my diploma from Effingham High School, so I have the same diploma that anyone else in my graduating class has. And Pathways was more my pace, like being an introvert and not a morning person. I got to go in at 10 a.m. and have like just a chill day, you know. And we also, we had a psychology class at Pathways, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the kids at Pathways had mental health disorders or substance use disorders. So they taught us about psychology, and I had taken a psych class, psych 1 and 2 in high school. And I, through that time, I found that I was really interested in it. And I liked learning how and why people do what they do and learning what makes people tick, you know?
Yeah.
And, that's just always been really interesting to me. And I've always wanted to help people ever since I was a little kid. And I used to think it would be as a doctor, and then realized I didn't like blood and surgery and stuff like that.
Sure.
So after studying psychology, I was like, maybe this is a way that I could help people if I go into the psychology field. So that was interesting in Pathways to learn more about like psychological disorders. And I think that kind of helped me understand a little bit.
Insight into yourself.
Yeah, about myself. And even though it still didn't really change anything, it was just nice insight.
So did you do college right out of high school, or what was post-high school
like? I actually started, I took, I think, two classes through Lakeland when I was still in high school. So I was doing dual credit, and they were psych classes. I started in the Associates of Psychology program through Lakeland. And so after I finished Pathways, I got a job at Menards, and I liked that. I was working like 39 hours a week, and I was making bank for a 17-year-old, you know, and I wasn't in school anymore, so I could work a lot. And it was not good for me to be making that much money as a 17-year-old with an addiction.
Yeah.
Cause I knew how to budget. But I was not doing it. I was just blowing all my money, and I was buying so much pills and weed. And, so that was around the time I started smoking weed. I had a friend introduce me to that, and, really liked it. That helped me get out of my right mind. Like I said, that was my goal all the time. And then I got fired from my job because I was showing up late and I missed days. I was just not a good worker at the time. And so I got fired. My parents were disappointed again. And then I just started spiraling. I didn't have school. I didn't have a job. And I think I was in classes at Lakeland at the time, but I was skipping them. I was skipping my night classes and just going out to do drugs and drink. And then I would come home from, quote, classes. And I, you know, would have the bloodshot eyes and be drunk, and my parents could tell. And, you know, they're like, why do you smell like that? I'm like, I don't know. You know, there was someone at class that smelled, and so I did too, because I sat by them. You know, just really bad lies. Like,
sure, yeah.
Just lying about everything. And so I started going out every night, and then there were nights that I wouldn't even come home, and my parents didn't know where I was. And it got to the point where my parents, with the other kids in the house, they couldn't have me stay there anymore. And so they politely asked me to leave. And even at the time, I understood that. I wasn't resentful, because I love my younger siblings. I've always been kind of protective of them. And so I understood their reasoning for that. And so I packed a backpack and a suitcase and called a friend and went and stayed at her place with her mom. And this is a friend that I did a lot of drinking and smoking weed with. Hmm. And so I went and stayed with her. And her mom knew about one of the guys that I was hanging out with and knew he was a really bad influence. And she said, you can stay here as long as you want, as long as you don't hang out with him. Hmm. And I was like, okay, that's fair, you know, and immediately was out hanging out with him.
Sure.
4 days later, she found out, and she showed up at the guy's house where I was, and was yelling for Caitlin to come out. And the guy was like, I think you better go out there. There's a lady yelling for you. And so I went out there, and she's like, I told you, that's the only rule I had. You know, you can't hang out with this guy, and you can't even follow one rule. So you can just stay with him, I guess. Just get your stuff and get out of my house. So, So I burned that bridge. And so I started staying with that guy, and he asked if I would date him, and I knew that that was an easy way to get free drugs if I would just date him, and so I did. And it was a free place to live, it was free drugs, it was free alcohol, and so I, you know, entered that relationship just as a means of getting what I wanted. And didn't really care about the guy at all, and he clearly didn't care about me. I was using weed and alcohol and started smoking K2 when I couldn't get weed. That was a thing back then. Which is terrible for you. It's just straight chemicals. Was really just out of my mind all the time, not really functional, walking everywhere. I didn't have a vehicle or a bike, so just really dysfunctional. And then he ended up cheating on me with his ex. She came back, and so I showed up one night, and she was there with him, and so then that was done. I was like, okay, this means of access is over. I didn't even see it really as like a relationship that ended. It was just like, that access to drugs is over now. So, so then I didn't have anywhere to go. And I ended up couch surfing for a while. And during that time, I met up with an acquaintance, someone I actually used to go to church with, who was also kicked out of her house. And so we kind of teamed up, and we were about the same age. And so we have similar backgrounds. So we just kind of went everywhere together at that point. We were both homeless. So we both couch surfed together, and we kind of pooled our resources, you know, the people that we knew. And she knew more people. She's more outgoing and extroverted than I am, so she had more of the people resources. And so she'd be like, oh, I know so and so, they'll let us stay at their house. And so we just kind of couch hopped and stayed with different people, and just were drinking and doing drugs and just being out of our minds all the time. And it's really a blur that time. I mean, I remember parts of it, but there's a lot that I don't remember too.
How long did that go on? Years?
No, it was a pretty quick, it was like several months. Well, the couch hopping part was probably like a month. And then there was a night where we didn't have anywhere to go. We didn't have anyone that had a place to stay. So it was May, and it was about 34 degrees and raining at night. It was really cold. And we were walking around, had this suitcase we were lugging around with us with all our belongings in it. And really a pathetic picture in my mind. Didn't have anywhere to go. And I was honestly like feeling really desperate and scared because I'm like, we're going to freeze out here in this rain at 34 degrees with nowhere to go. I'm like, I don't want to sleep on a park bench. And we had kind of used up all our resources. And so I ended up calling my parents in desperation. And I hadn't had much contact with them. And I called them and I was basically like, we don't have anywhere to go. You know, can we stay with you or do you have somewhere we can stay? And they didn't want us to stay at their house, understandably.
Sure.
But they had a vacant apartment and they said, we'll bring some sleeping bags and you can sleep on the floor at this apartment for tonight. And so we did that. And then they were like, okay, you can stay here for the week. And so we kind of just moved in at that point, and we were staying in this vacant apartment for free. And then my mom and dad worked out a deal with us that we could stay there on an ongoing basis if we abided by, you know, their terms. And I don't remember what all the terms were, but they were trying to help us straighten out our lives, sure, basically. Yeah. And of course we just had blatant disregard for that. And we're like, yeah, we'll follow the rules. And then just went out and did whatever we wanted. And during that time, while we were staying at the apartment, I was at a, you can't really call it a party. It's more like a trap house where people just kind of sit around and shoot drugs and just nod off, and Pink Floyd music plays in the background and
yeah,
no one really knows what's going on. So I was at one of those places and I was sitting on a couch next to two guys that were nodding off from heroin. And the one guy that I was sitting next to, he kind of rolled his head over to the side to look at me. And he was like, you want to try heroin? Mm. And the other guy was like, hey, man, don't ask people that. He's like, you can't be turning people onto this stuff. And I thought that was interesting that even as a person who was currently high on heroin knew that it wasn't good to turn people onto that.
Yeah, sure.
But I was like, sure, why not? You know, haven't tried that one yet. And so we went in the bathroom and he showed me how to shoot up heroin. And and so then I was a heroin user. And
it became a regular thing?
Yeah, I really liked it. I liked it so much. Just the feeling that it gives you of being completely numb. You can't feel anything. Mm-hmm. And not to try to glamorize it or anything, because it's terrible for you. I mean, people die from it all the time.
Yeah. But that's what you were trying to do this whole time.
Yeah, I was trying to cover the pain.
Yeah.
And that did it. And it did it so well. I couldn't feel anything. It just made me feel warm and fuzzy and heavy and light at the same time. You know, my blood would get warm and I couldn't think of anything bad. And everything just went away for that time. And it would last a few hours and then wear off, and then I would try to find more. And I made friends with this guy who was diabetic, and so he had access to needles, because at the time you couldn't just go to a pharmacy and get clean needles. So there was a lot of sharing of dirty needles, and which is super dangerous. And so I had a friend who I could get needles from sometimes, if he had extras. And, so I kind of entered into a relationship with that guy. And again, not because I cared about him, but just as another means to an end.
Yeah.
And so he supplied me with needles and heroin and a relationship and, other resources. And he actually had a car, so he could drive me places. Which is scary to think of someone on heroin driving a vehicle. And man, that's when I was just, I don't think I ever knew what was going on at that point. I had cigarette burns in our couch and on my clothes and stuff, just from like nodding off while holding a lit cigarette and, you know, getting burns and stuff. And, so that was a blur. I never, interestingly enough, I never did shoot up myself. I was too scared. I always had someone else do it for me. But I got to the point where, I was so sick. I thought I had the flu or something, because I was sick in my bones, you know, like my bones hurt.
Wow.
And I didn't know what it was, because it was July and it was so hot outside. And I'm like, why am I like freezing cold? And I didn't know at the time that that was actually withdrawal from heroin, because I wasn't getting it as often as my body needed it at that point.
Yeah.
And the addiction, the dependency had increased to the point where I needed it more often, and I wasn't able to get it as often as my body wanted it.
Sure.
So I was just always like aching, and this went on for like, I feel like a few weeks, and I'm like, it can't be the flu. The flu doesn't last that long. And I didn't know what was going on, and it didn't occur to me that I was so addicted that I was having withdrawal. I didn't think I was that addicted. I thought I was just using it for fun, you know?
Sure.
And my roommate and I, the one I was going everywhere with, we started breaking into one of our neighbor's apartments. He was someone that we used weed with, and he grew it or something. He had a large supply all the time. He was a dealer, and which was, I mean, weed was still illegal at the time. And so we would use with him, and I think he just liked our company or something. He would smoke us up for free. But we wanted more and more, and we were greedy, and we weren't happy with what he was supplying us with. And so we started breaking into his apartment and stealing what we could find. And we were really, I mean, it was really criminal thinking, because we paid attention. We like scoped out the neighborhood for a while and like learned when people came and went, and we learned when the best time was to break into his apartment. And we realized it was in the middle of the day when most people were at work. So in broad daylight, every single day, we were breaking into this man's apartment and stealing his weed or money or whatever we could find.
Yeah.
And eventually he got tired of it. And
so he knew you were doing it, but
yeah, he knew, but he eventually he did slam the door in my face one day, because he knew that we were doing that and we wouldn't admit to it, and he couldn't prove it. He was just so mad.
Sure.
And so then I was angry, because he slammed the door in my face. I'm like, you don't do that to me. I was like, I'll take everything this guy has. So then I told my roommate, I was like, he slammed the door in my face. Let's go take whatever we can find, you know? And that's when he set up a camera, and he caught us on camera breaking into his apartment. So one day my mom was nice enough to take my roommate and I to the grocery store to get our food, and this was still when I was having the body aches and everything, and I was so sick. It was August 7th or maybe 5th, I don't know, somewhere near the beginning of August in 2013. And it was so hot outside, but I was wearing a hoodie and sweatpants and winter boots because I was so cold.
Wow.
And it had to be like 100 degrees out. It was so hot. And we pulled back up to the apartment from the grocery store, and there were cop cars all over the parking lot. Oh, and wow. They were like taking fingerprints and like the front window of this apartment that we were breaking into was busted, which we did not do. I will maintain that we were able to break in without breaking things. And, but the front window was busted. So they were taking pictures and they were talking to my dad. He was there. And I knew as soon as we pulled up, I got this feeling in my stomach of dread. And I just knew that we had been caught. And, and so we pulled up and my mom was like, oh no, what happened? And I didn't say anything, you know, and we went in, we took our groceries in and set them down on the floor by the fridge. And I just went and laid down on the couch cause I was so sick. And this detective, came in and he saw me laying on the couch and he just smiled at me with this smile that said, I got you. Like you've been busted. And he smiled at me. He said, you know, you just committed a class one felony, right? And I just smiled back in a way that said, I don't care. And I was like, oh, I did I? And he was like, I'm going to give you time to finish putting your groceries in the fridge and then you're going to jail. And so they were nice enough not to handcuff me in front of my parents. But I was taken to jail and booked. And that's where I withdrew from heroin and pills and alcohol and weed. And that was terrible.
All at once.
Yeah. And back then, or at least not in Effingham County, I don't know if other places did this at the time. Nowadays, you can get medicine in jail to help withdraw so that it's not so miserable. I did not get that. So I did it the old-fashioned way, which is crying and sweating and rocking back and forth and shaking and being depressed and either not being able to sleep or sleeping all the time.
Yeah.
So that was like my first 2 weeks in jail, was just coming down off of everything. And I did so much crying. I begged my parents to get me out of jail, but they were like, we think you need to stay there for your own good, which I totally understand that now. But at the time I was like, how dare they leave me here? You know?
So this was kind of the turning moment for you, even whenever you shared it. Even when you shared on Easter, you had talked about how like going to jail and detoxing in jail, like that was a bit of a turning point, especially facing like the sentence that potentially like, cause it was like close. You could have faced up to close to 15 years.
Yeah.
Something like that.
So after kind of like the withdrawal got less severe, it kind of tapered off and I wasn't crying as much. I got an NA book and a Bible, and because you can request books in jail, and they have Bibles and NA books readily in jail, because a lot of people ask for those. So I started reading the Bible and the Big Book, and my family was sending me letters, and there was a hymn that I think it might have been my grandma's. Or maybe it was my mom. I don't know. One of them sent me the lyrics to a hymn that was, I think it's called like In the Potter's Hands or something like that. And it talks about like mold me and make me after thy will and shape me. And I was just like, that's what I want. And I was just crying out to God in jail. I was like, please just shape me, make me into something else. I don't want to be like this person anymore. I'm miserable. And that's where my internal mindset finally started to shift, where I finally wanted something different. And I didn't really know how or when or what that would look like, but I just knew I didn't want to be like that anymore. And then also going back to the beginning of when I went to jail, when you go to jail, you have an arraignment hearing, which is where you go before a judge and they tell you what you're officially being charged with and what maximum sentence that could possibly carry, just so you're informed. And so I went before the judge in my jumpsuit and chains literally on my hands and feet. Mm. And my parents were there too, which was one of the most humiliating moments of my life, you know, walking into jail in literal shackles in front of my parents. Yeah,
that would be tough.
Yeah, it was so hard. And I mean, I'm sure it was incredibly hard for them too, to see their daughter like that. And so I walked in and the judge told me that I was being charged with residential burglary and retail theft, because I was a chronic shoplifter too, and I got caught shoplifting alcohol from A1 as a minor. And so retail theft, which is a misdemeanor, and I think can carry like a year or two in jail, I'm not sure, I don't really remember. And and residential burglary, which is a class one felony, and she said that carried a sentence of 4 to 15 years in prison, extendable up to 30 without possibility of parole. And that's when my mind just went like black. I was like, I couldn't even process that, you know. I was like, 4 to 15 years in prison, me? You know, I'm not prison material, you know. I would get eaten alive in prison, probably. And I was just like, I'm 19, you know, I can't go to prison. I have my whole life ahead of me, you know. Even in 4 years, I would only be 23, you know.
Yeah.
I'm like, I can't even do 4 years in prison. I have things I want to do. And I was in shock. And my mind went blank, and the judge was asking me, you know, ma'am, do you understand the charges? And she had said some stuff and I didn't hear it because I was in shock. I was like, I'm sorry, Your Honor, can you repeat that? Because I really didn't hear. And so she repeated what she said, and she's like, do you understand the charges? And I said, yes, Your Honor. But I was just, for the next few days, I feel like I was still in shock. And so, yeah, finished withdrawing and then started coming back around to the idea of I need something else. Mm. And
that need and desire for God was still there.
Yeah.
Even if buried under lots
of
things.
I knew to ask for a Bible. I knew to cry out to God. And I knew that if I wanted to be different, that was going to be the way. And I still didn't really know how to do that. I didn't know what that would look like, but I knew that that was the route I was going to have to take if I wanted something to change.
Which you ended up not actually spending any time in, like, prison.
Correct. Yes, thankfully. Because I'm not prison material. Yeah. But yeah, since it was a first offense, the judge was gracious, and I pled guilty to the misdemeanor theft charge. And so they dropped the residential burglary, and I was sentenced to 2 years of probation and substance abuse counseling. They told me I had to be actively looking for a job, and a whole bunch of fines, at which they made me pay restitution for that window that was busted. And that I'm still upset about that. I did not break that window. Okay.
Sure.
I was better than that. But no, I paid it anyway. I'm like, I guess, you know, in the grand scheme of things, what's $40 for a window?
Yeah.
Cause I know windows cost more than that.
You did end up finding freedom from these things. It just took some time, right?
Yeah. So I did go to substance abuse counseling, and I got on probation, and I did well on probation for a while. My parents ended up letting me move back in with them. Since I was on probation, I wasn't going to be able to use. And I was scared, honestly, for quite a while after I got out. I didn't want to go anywhere by myself. I was just scared. I was afraid of getting in trouble again. I didn't want to go back to jail. I didn't want to use drugs anymore. And I did use heroin one more time after that. In October of 2013, I went down to the park by our house and met my old friends, and they gave me some heroin, and I snorted it at home that night. And it was in my sister's bedroom. I was sharing the room with my littlest sister, and I was just laying on the floor, high as all get out. And when I, woke up the next day, I was like, I just felt like such trash, because I'm like, how could I do that to my family? You know, what if I had died there on the floor and my little sister woke up and found me dead, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, she's like a baby, you know, she's my baby sister. I love her so much. And I'm like, how could I do that? You know, that's so selfish. And so I never used heroin again after that. I think it was October 2nd of 2013. And it was really hard. I had times where I would just sit on my hands, and I had to literally throw my phone away from me, because I knew if I had it in my hand, I would call somebody and get something. So I would just throw my phone, and I would sit on my hands and just wait out the cravings. And it took all my willpower. And I was still kind of trying to do it by myself at the time. I wasn't really seeking help from God that much. But yeah, he got me through that time. And then, yeah, over the years, God slowly started breaking all the chains.
Yeah,
which was really cool to see. I went, after I graduated from Lakeland while I was on probation, moved to Charleston in at the end of 2014, started working at Casey's there. I was going to school at EIU. I did start partying again after I got off probation, and I was doing pills and Tylenol with codeine and Xanax and all kinds of stuff, and I was still out of my right mind a lot, and I slipped back into that, and I started failing my classes again.
How long was it before you met Richard?
So I met Richard at the end of 2015.
Okay.
So what happened in Charleston when I started failing my classes, my parents were like, maybe it's time to move back to Effingham and kind of take a break from school until you're more stable. And I agreed to that. And I was like, that's fair, because I had kind of lost interest in school at that point. And so I moved back to Effingham in December of 2015. And Richard actually had moved back from Maryland at the beginning of December 2015. And on Christmas night, we both had done our stuff with our family for the day, and we both ended up at the Orchard Bar in Effingham. And I was there with a guy, I mean, not like with, but I was just there with him. And he knew Richard too. So he introduced me to Richard, and I thought he was kind of cute with his big brown eyes, and his his sense of fashion was different than Effingham's sense of fashion. It was better than most people in Effingham's sense of fashion. And, he was wearing a big red puffer jacket. I'm like, who does that? And so we talked for a couple minutes, and then he went to talk to somebody else, and I ended up leaving in that time. And he'll tell you a different story, but he ended up finding me on Facebook the next day through our mutual friend and messaged me on Facebook. He was like, hey, how you doing? I was like, oh, great, another drunk guy at a bar wants to talk. And so I kind of blew him off for a week, but I finally gave him my number, and we started hanging out and partying together. And about a month later, I was pregnant with our first child. And that was a shock to my parents. But we decided that we wanted to stay together and that we wanted to raise our child together. And so we moved in together, and we ended up getting married 8 months after our son was born. We didn't want to do like a shotgun wedding.
Sure.
So it was during the time that I was pregnant with our first son that I started to have this internal kind of resistance, like a dichotomy. You know, I knew that I wanted to raise my child to be in the faith, and I wanted to raise him in the way that I was raised in the church, and I wanted him to be a good person and have a relationship with God. But I also knew the way that I was still living, smoking cigarettes and weed all the time, and using porn, and just this sinful, fleshly kind of way of living. And I knew that you can't live one way and expect someone else to live another way. You know, I couldn't just be like, well, I'm going to live this way, but I'm going to tell you this, and I expect you to live that way. And so I knew that either my son was, if I stayed that way, my son was going to grow up to be like that, or I was going to have to change something.
Yeah.
And God ended up winning, and I decided it was time to change some things. So started partying less, and you know, slowly God started to break those chains as I became willing.
Well, that's what I love, like it, and whenever you're sharing the Easter testimony, you started just naming off, and I mean, it was almost like rapid fire, like on this date God broke the chains of this, on this date God broke, and you just named all these things, and I'm just sitting there like, whoa. Which that's, I mean, it's cool, like Noah's story, it's funny, and I loved having both stories there, because for Noah's story, everything was broken at once.
Yeah.
It was just like this one moment, like light, you know, light switch was flipped night and day. But for yours, it was a gradual thing.
Yeah.
Where it was like there was, it was almost like, I don't know what they're, layers of an onion or something like that. Yeah. Where it's like slowly these things were peeled off and broken off. And, and that's powerful. Yeah. And that's a lot of people's experiences. Some people do have that experience of like, they have this one experience that changed everything. Other people, it's like, no, there's this process where I have to do the hard work of repentance and change over time and die to myself on a regular basis, sometimes multiple times, to shake one particular thing off. And like, anyway, I saw that in you. Like, I noticed that in your story, which is just really powerful.
And I did that on purpose. I wanted kind of like a whole barrage of like all the things that God did, because it's so powerful to look back now and see that, how one at a time God was breaking all these things. And I guess, I don't know why, you know, for some people it is all at once, like with Noah's story, but I feel like for a lot of people that's not the case. And I also kind of just wanted to let everyone know it's okay if you're a Christian and you still have problems, and it's okay if you become a Christian and everything doesn't change all at once. That's okay, because once you have the Holy Spirit inside of you, He starts working in you, and He will change you a little bit at a time and make you over time more into His image. And that's a really cool process, and it's never finished. You know, like my story's not done now. Yeah. Just because I'm sharing my testimony now doesn't mean it's over. You know, I'm still alive. I'm still breathing, and I'm only 29. So hopefully I have a lot of life left, you know? Yeah,
absolutely.
And God's going to continue to work in whatever time I have left. And it's, you know, hopefully it's still just the beginning.
Yeah. And I love it that, I mean, you're part of our community now, and it's just been cool to see, just even in the years that you've been here, what God has done and continues to do. And it's like, even the ministry that you're now a part of, like you're helping with that like healing and recovery group, which is so powerful. Yes. Like, I just love that so much.
I love how that's come together.
Do you want to give a shout out for that real quick?
Yeah, of course. So a few of us at New Hope, including myself, have approached Aaron Golden at different times and expressed interest in starting a healing and recovery group, not specifically for addiction, but for all kinds of hurts, whatever that may be, because people need healing from all kinds of things, whether it be addiction or trauma or grief or codependency, depression, you know, it goes on and on. But no matter what we need healing from, the healing comes from the same place, which is Jesus.
Amen.
And so we wanted a group where we can just focus on Jesus being the source of our healing. And so that's what we started. We had our first meeting last Sunday, April 7th. It's going to be every Sunday from 5 to 6 here at New Hope in room 301.
Yeah.
And if we run out of room, we will meet in the cafe. And if we run out of room, we'll meet in the sanctuary. Yeah. You know, we'll figure it out.
Absolutely.
So we welcome anyone who has any kind of hurt, which I feel like is everyone.
Yeah.
Currently, we're doing a study called The Bridge, which applies the 12 steps to all kinds of hurts. So this coming week, we'll be going over steps 2 and 3 in the process. No, I take that back. We're diving deeper into the first step, and then the next week we're doing steps 2 and 3.
Nice.
So yeah, anyone is welcome. We hope to see you there.
Awesome. Caitlin, thank you so much for sharing your story. That man, just to see, no matter how dark the darkness, like you see the faith, like I just noticed that thread of like the faithfulness of God woven into what was happening. It's like there were some dark moments there.
But he never left me.
But you see this, like there's that desire, no matter how deeply it was buried. It's like almost like a seed, and Jesus used a lot of seed language. Yeah. It's going to sprout one way or another.
And, you know, I think back now, and I imagine Jesus in those moments, in the darkest moments where I, you know, was a victim of sexual trauma, and where I was watching porn, and where I was using drugs, and I imagine Jesus there, you know, in the bathroom the first time that guy shot heroin into my arms, and I imagine Jesus just standing there in the corner just watching, just being like, you know, sad, brokenhearted, obviously, but just being like I still got you, I'm still here,
still haven't you left know you.
And he's always there, and I know he was there even in my darkest times, and he's still here. So
Well, thank you, Caitlin. Yeah. Thank you for everyone sticking around and listening. Man, it's such a powerful story. Thank you.
It's long.
I just know it's good. It was, you needed to be told. It couldn't just be a 5 to 7 minute thing. So thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me. And, I appreciate it.
We will see you guys next time on New Hope Underground.